The following message, Songs of Ascent No. 2, was delivered to the adult Bible class of Emmanuel Reformed Baptist Church of SeaTac, Washington, on Sunday, October 14, 2018, by Pastor John Ruther of Covenant Baptist Church, Lumberton, New Jersey.
So last time I was here, just a month ago, we were talking about the Songs of Ascent, and I'm sure you have somewhere back at home. I wouldn't expect you to have it today. The sheet that I gave out last month, which was the Songs of Ascent. So that's where we are. Please turn there to this little collection of psalms, starting at Psalm 120. And I won't take any more than a minute or two just to say a few words about what we studied last month. But on the sheet here, this one-page sheet, there was the meaning of the word ascents, going up. Talks about going up to the temple, going up to the feasts, the Jewish people going up to the temple, up to Mount Zion, which was up, wherever you were coming from, north or south. And then the position of these psalms in the Psalter, they're in Book 5. That's the book that deals with the Reformation and the restoration of Israel, revival. They have come back into their land. One of the main features of these Songs of Ascents is that they echo the Aaronic blessing in Numbers 6, verse 24 through 27. The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord be gracious to you and give you peace. Make his face shine upon you and lift up his countenance on you. Although the last one isn't mentioned in these Psalms, make his face shine upon you and lift his countenance upon you. But I think that it's very similar to what a couple of these Psalms talk about, waiting on the Lord and looking to the Lord until he is gracious to us. And then the theology of the Psalms of Ascents, they talk about the temple, the house of the Lord, the city, Jerusalem, sons of David, the covenant, and so on. And then at the very bottom, I just gave each one a word or two, a little handle so you could get a feel for the content of the psalm. So what I would like to do today, I decided what the best way to do this today in one class is just to pick a few of them, just to pick a few of these psalms and just talk about them. So I've picked four, and they are so somewhat related. The Psalm 121, 123, 125, and 131, somewhat related on the theme of trusting the Lord. You could pick another group. It might be the Psalms of the actual psalms of worship, like Psalm 122. I was glad when they said, let us go up to the house of the Lord. Psalm 126, 127. So we could do that as well. But today, we'll just look at these four, because these, I think, are the most encouraging psalms for us. Keep in mind that these songs of ascents are, for the most part, pretty short. And so they're easy to memorize. I was just quoting Psalm 121 to myself last night, just trying to, going to sleep. So they're perfect for that. Help us to sleep and trust in the Lord. So they're a beautiful psalm. So we're going to look at the four of them. Let's see. Psalm 121. I will lift up my eyes to the mountains. From where shall my help come? My help comes from the Lord who made heaven and earth. He will not allow your foot to slip. He who keeps you will not slumber. Behold, he who keeps Israel will neither slumber nor sleep. The Lord is your keeper. The Lord is your shade on your right hand. The sun will not smite you by day, nor the moon by night. The Lord will protect you from all evil. He will keep your soul. The Lord will guard your going out and your coming in from this time forth and forever. And then Psalm 123, to you I lift up my eyes, O you who are enthroned in the heavens. Behold, as the eyes of servants look to the hand of their master, as the eyes of a maid to the hand of her mistress, so our eyes look to the Lord our God until he is gracious to us. Be gracious to us, O Lord. Be gracious to us, for we are greatly filled with contempt. Our soul is greatly filled with the suffering or the scoffing of those who are at ease and with the contempt of the proud. And then the next one we'll look at is Psalm 125. Those who trust in the Lord are as Mount Zion, which cannot be moved but abides forever. As the mountains surround Jerusalem, so the Lord surrounds his people from this time forth and forever. For the scepter of wickedness shall not rest upon the land of the righteous, so that the righteous will not put forth their hands to do wrong. Do good, O Lord, to those who are good and to those who are upright in their hearts. But as for those who turn aside to their crooked ways, the Lord will lead them away with the doers of iniquity. Peace be upon Israel. And the last one is Psalm 131. O Lord, my heart is not proud, nor my eyes haughty, nor do I involve myself in great matters or in things too difficult for me. Surely I have composed and quieted my soul like a weaned child rests against his mother. My soul is like a weaned child within me. O Israel, hope in the Lord from this time forth and forever. So generally it wouldn't be a good idea in a class like this to take four different chapters or four different psalms, because you would feel like you're just going from one thing to the other, kind of jumping around. That's why I tried to pick four that are somewhat related. I keep saying somewhat. They're very related. On the subject of trusting the Lord, I've given it a little heading here. The Psalm of the Lord's Keeping is Psalm 121. Psalm 123, the Psalm of Looking to the Lord Until He is Gracious. Psalm 125, the Psalm of Trust or Trusting the Lord. And then Psalm 131, the Psalm of Contentment. And the illustration of the weaned child is very beautiful. So, and I've also put there, except for Psalm 131, which isn't an echo of the Aaronic blessing like these other ones, because it doesn't have the language of the Aaronic blessing in it, but the other ones do. The Lord bless you and keep you, number 624. Be gracious to you, number 625. And the Lord give you peace, number 626. And I mentioned last month that this looking back to the Aaronic blessing is not a wooden kind of a thing. These psalms, which are all composed in different settings, and there are a few different authors here as well, it's not a wooden, like, oh, let's make sure I'm going to make sure I get the Aaronic blessing in there. It just flows naturally from the heart. So we don't expect to see it in every single one. But the general idea of the songs of ascents is that they are speaking of this blessing. And the Aaronic blessing is a big part of Old Testament religion and reminds us of the Lord, our Lord, when he went up, when he was ascended to heaven, he stretched out his hands and he blessed the people because he's our great high priest. And knowing God and being a Christian is all about blessing, right? It's the greatest blessing that anyone can know, is to know God and to be saved by the work of Christ. And God just pours out his blessings on his people all the time. So let's look at Psalm 121 then. And what I would like to do here is suggest that we'll do something that I would suggest that you try to do in your own Bible study. And that is to, when you look at a psalm like this, to ask yourself, well, what is the main point of this psalm? Is there one main point? And is there any structure in the psalm? There's a tendency for me, just as for you, I'm sure, is to look at a psalm like this and just take the verse that gives the most comfort, right? Like Psalm 125, for example. Those who trust in the Lord are as Mount Zion, which cannot be moved but abides forever. But the whole psalm, the psalm is in a certain context of trouble. So you don't want to divorce it from the context of the psalm. So you try to look at it and say, what are the main headings here? What are the main ideas? And so, unfortunately, since we don't have a lot of time, we wouldn't be able to have a work session, or this could take a few weeks, and I would ask you, well, what do you see? So we can't do that. We just don't have the time. So I'm just going to tell you what I see, and maybe you can do this yourself with some of these others. But in this psalm, I see two divisions, and this is not like trying to prepare a sermon or anything like that. It's just trying to get at what the psalm is talking about. So I see in verses 1 and 2 what I'll call our help, and then verses 3 through 8, our helper at work. So sometimes when you put a handle on a passage or a section in a passage, it helps you to understand it better, helps you to appreciate it better, and just part of not just interpretation, but just Bible study. It's a good Bible study to try to do this. So we'll talk about the two divisions, our help and our helper at work. And of course, as you can see in the titles, I've isolated the word help, because it seems to me that word is the main idea. I will lift up my eyes to the mountains. From where shall my help come? My help comes from the name of the Lord. So as far as this little gem of a psalm, I would say help is the main idea. And of course, we need help. So, I mean, we need help every day. So it's very practical. So, and then with that idea of help, which you see in verses 1 and 2, my help comes from the Lord, is the corresponding idea, which is a big one, in verses 3 and 4, which is the keeping. So we call this the Psalm of the Lord's Keeping. And as one writer, one of the writers on these psalms, can't remember which one, said that this psalm is an exposition of number 624, the Lord bless you and keep you. So it just tells you how he does it. That's the idea. So we'll divide it up then into these two. I'll try to give 15 minutes to each one or so. But we'll divide it into these two sections, our help, which is verses 1 and 2, and then our helper at work. So under this first section here, verses 1 and 2, we are reminded, and we don't really need reminding of this, we need help. Some people need to be reminded that they need help. And some people are really in trouble and they don't realize it. They have a big problem and they just don't realize it. They live in denial, perhaps, and you have to. That's the need of the hour. And people like that is to try to help, to try to get them to see that, hey, you know, you need help at the rate you're going or the way you're going. But most of us know our need for help, and so we go to the Lord for this. And that's a good place to be, is to know that we all need help. So divided it up then, this is our help, verses 1 and 2, we need help. Our sense of need is in verse 1. See that? So the psalmist is showing that he has this sense of need. He does this. He lifts up his eyes and asks the question, from where shall my help come? It actually is a question in the original language. It could just as well be translated, I will lift up my eyes to the mountains from where my help comes. But either way, it's really the same idea. My help comes from the Lord. So the answer, my help comes from the Lord, is the sense of direction that we have. So I would outline it this way. Our help, our sense of need, verse 1, and our sense of direction, verse 2. So I know I need help, and I know where to go for my help. And we're going to find the same thing in Psalm 123. I know what I need, and I know where to go for my help. And that, obviously, some people don't know where to go for help in life. And this is another one of the great blessings of being a child of God, is that we know where to go for help. So then you have, in these first two verses, the image. And poetry is like that. Poetry presents images to communicate lessons or truths. And so you not only have the word help, the word keep in verse 3 and 4 and 5 and 7, but in verses 1 and 2 you have the imagery of the mountains. So you have different images here. In Psalm 121 it's the image of the mountains. In Psalm 123 it's the image of the servant and the maid. The servant and the master, the maid and the mistress, so that's a different image in Psalm 123. In Psalm 125, it's mountains, it's Zion. And in Psalm 123, it's the child, the weaned child. So these are just images, that the poetic images that help us to... The purpose of an image here is to get us emotionally involved, because that's what poetry tries to do. It's emotional. I don't write poetry. I'm sure some of you here do, but I appreciate poetry, and Bible poetry is no different than any other poetry, except that it's based on truth and not just feelings. But it shows us that God is. He addresses our feelings, and our faith should have emotion to it. So, You have the mountains, verse 2. I'm sorry, the mountains are mentioned in Psalm 125 and verse 2, trying to tie these together. As the mountains surround Jerusalem, so the Lord surrounds his people. Psalm 133, another song of ascent. The song of ascents go from 120 to 134, so Psalm 133 talks about the mountains also in verse 7. Verse 3, coming down upon the mountains of Zion, verse 3. Oh, I must have the wrong reference there, so it's verse 3. So there is the presentation of our help. And then I called the second section Our Helper at Work, verses 3 through 8, because it seems to me to be speaking about how he does this. So you have two ideas in verses 3 through 8. And maybe I will be able to ask you, I think we have enough time for this, what are the two main things that the Lord does in verses 3 through 8? What are the two important words here?
Keeper
is the first one, used several times, and then
preserve
in verse 7. Keeper 7 and 8, protect you, he will keep, he will guard, protect. Oh, so your version probably says preserve. Verse 7, he will preserve you from all evil. Okay, so it's a matter of translation. Protect, preserve, or guard. Verse 8, guard. Guard your going out and your coming in. So however it works out in the English translations here, I just have, he's our keeper and our protector or guardian, preserver. So the first idea of keeping comes from Numbers 6 and verse 24. The Lord bless you and keep you. So that's the way the Lord blesses us, by keeping us. The idea of the foot, your foot will not slip. If you have a reference Bible or a study Bible or something, you'll probably see a reference to Psalm 66 and verse 9. So that's an important reference, Psalm 66 and verse 9. He who keeps us in life and does not allow our feet to slip. So this is a big problem that we have, and one of the ways in which our need is felt, that we feel like, Lord, I'm going to slip here. I feel like I'm slipping. So I feel like I'm slipping. Have you ever felt that way? I feel like I'm slipping in my Christian faith. Or someone may come to you, someone who loves you, and say, you know, I think you're slipping a little bit here. And slipping can also be a major fall. Some fall into sin, so it can be either just a big fall, or it can just be a slow decline. But the promise is that our helper is keeping us. He's blessing us and keeping us. And then the other idea then is the idea of the protector or the guardian. The image here is the image of the shade. The sun will not smite you by day, nor the moon by night. Kyle and Dalish were talking about, it's amazing for some, writing for that long ago, with a little less scientific savvy than we have today, was talking about, you know, the negative effects that the moon can have on you. So I don't know about that, but it does say the sun will not smite you by day nor the moon by night. I don't know if any one of us have been smitten by the moon at night in a bad way, but according to this psalm, it can happen. But the image, it's just the image of the shade. You think of Jonah in Jonah 4 and verse 8, how the sun came up and withered. In 2 Kings chapter 4 and verse 19, the Shunammite's son, remember, came in running and had some kind of sunstroke or something like that. So you have the imagery of not only the mountains, but also the image of the sun and the shade doing us harm. So that's a physical phenomenon, doing us physical harm. But I think the application or the use or the application is found in verse 8, where it says the Lord will guard your going out and your coming in from this time forth and forever. So that's where it seems to me that this psalm points to this going out and coming in. And this going out and coming in is a phrase that's found in the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 28 and verse 6. Again, if you have a reference Bible, The best tool for Bible study is actually a reference Bible. Just references on the side. If you have those, don't think that because they're so small and all that they're not that important. That's the best tool that you have, because whoever put those in there was just a master at connecting scriptures up, and they're always reliable, and they will usually point you to related verses that are critical for understanding a particular verse that you're studying. So the Deuteronomy 28 and verse 6 talks about, in that section, you have the curses and the blessings after they have solemnized the covenant, and then you have the curses on Mount Ebal and the blessings on Mount Gerizim. And it's really a fascinating section, those later chapters in Deuteronomy. But in 28 and verse 6, it says, "Blessed shall you be when you come in, blessed shall you be when you go out." The context is verse 3, "Blessed shall you be in the city, blessed shall you be in the country, blessed shall you be the offspring of your body and the produce of your ground and the offspring of your breasts and the increase of your beasts and the increase of your herd and the young of your flock. Blessed shall be your basket and your kneading bowl, and blessed shall you be when you come in, and blessed shall you be when you go out." So it's the whole idea of just life going in and going out. It reminds you of Deuteronomy chapter 6. Remember, when you lie down at night, when you wake up in the morning, when you go about. And so it's just all about everyday life. And so the psalm is a great comfort, and I hope that it'll bring great comfort to you in your life, for the rest of your life. I like what Kylan Dalich called it at one point. I'm not sure what verse he was talking about. The eyes of providence. I like that. I like that expression. The eyes of providence. So Psalm 123. Any thoughts or questions you want to add or anything to that? Again, we're skipping here through four psalms. All right, so let's do Psalm 123. Again, I'll read it. "To you I lift up my eyes, O you who are enthroned in the heavens. Behold, as the eyes of servants look to the hand of their master, as the eyes of a maid to the hand of her mistress, so our eyes look to the Lord our God until he is gracious to us. Be gracious to us, O Lord, be gracious to us, for we are greatly filled with contempt. Our soul is greatly filled with the scoffing of those who are at ease and with the contempt of the proud." So sometimes when I'm looking at a passage like this, you know, I do look at some what other writers have said, and I like Kylan Dalich on the Old Testament. And so sometimes, and you may have a devotional book that you read, or you may be going through a popular commentary, and sometimes that will spark some ideas for you or help you to go further with it. So that happened to me in reading Kylan Dalich on this psalm, where they talked about the upward glance of waiting faith. And I thought, oh, that's really the idea of Psalm 123, the upward glance of waiting faith. "To you I lift up my eyes." So it's all about the eyes, lifting up the eyes. And then the image here is the servant and the maid. And it's the same with the servant and the maid. They lift up their eyes. So there's an emphasis on looking in verses 1 and 2, which is most of the psalm here. And then the transitional statement, "until he is gracious to us," and then the prayer, "be gracious to us." So it's all about being gracious to us, and it comes through looking. So in terms of finding some headings for this psalm, I settled on verses 1 and 2, our gaze, because that's the upward glance of the waiting faith, our gaze, and then our grip. It seems to me that the word grip is the best word I could find. Usually look on some kind of thesaurus, either the electronic one or the hard copy one, and try to find a good word. And that's the best word for this, because you have the gaze, which is the look, and then you have the word "until." See, the word "until" is a key word here. And why is that? I shouldn't say why is that, because I'm telling you that I think "until" is a key word. So why might I say that? Yes.
It seems like it's showing both patience and faith. It's the expectation that God will have mercy, mm-hmm. but has to be waited
that's good, and you're getting there. I mean, you're pretty close, very close, but it's waiting. But go a little further then with that, the word until. My eyes look to the Lord until he is gracious.
There's hope.
You're getting closer.
Certainty.
What?
Certainty.
Certainty, yep. The floor is still open. Well, the word until means that you're not going to stop until something happens. So it's everything you're saying is correct. But that's why I use the word grip, because I will look to the Lord until he is gracious to me. So that it's like saying I'm not going to give up. So that's the idea where the idea of the grip comes in. I'm not going to give up. I'm not going to stop looking to the Lord until this happens. And this is important in life, because we do tend to give up. We have hope, but then because it takes so long, look at Abraham and Sarah. They had hope, they had promises, but they didn't wait long enough. So you have the two ideas then, our gaze and our grip. Again, we're just trying to, it's somewhat of an exercise what we're doing today, and trying to help you. I always try to help the saints in the Sunday school class to, not usually try to do this, help them to study the Bible for themselves as well. So, because sometimes people say, well, I don't get much out of my devotions, so I usually say, well, you have to do something. Do some exercise or something, or do something different, do something creative, do a word study, or do something like this. Try to see the structure, the main ideas, and then one thing will lead to the other, and the passage will open up to you. So this is not just something that preachers do. I mean, this does sound like 2 points of a sermon, doesn't it? I've never preached a sermon on Psalm 123 with our gaze and our grip. But it's not about preaching a sermon, but it's more about getting at the meaning of the psalm. So those are the two main ideas, our gaze and our grip. And it took me a while to get to those. I had other words in there. So you have to work at it for a while until you feel you've really gotten to the meat of it. So let's talk about then the gaze. You can say that the gaze, this upward glance of waiting faith, we know where to look. We know where to look. I lift up my eyes to you who are enthroned in the heavens. So this is definitely an upward glance of waiting faith. Unlike Psalm 125, which talks about a physical phenomenon, Mount Zion, and shows that the people actually looked like a pilgrim. It was a pilgrimage. They looked to the mountains. When they got closer to Jerusalem, they felt relief and safety. But here in Psalm 123, it's different. It's the direction is the heavens. So where we look and then how we look. We could call that the attitude, perhaps, how we look. We look as servants and maids. As is the analogy. As the eyes of the servants look to the hand of their master, as the eyes of a maid to the hand of her mistress, so our eyes look to the Lord our God until he is gracious to us. And that leads you to the second section, which is what we call the grip. And then you have that, the grip, until he is gracious to us, verses 3 and 4. That I divide that up into the outside and the inside. Trouble from the outside, and trust on the inside. Verse 3, that's the trouble. We are greatly filled with contempt. Our soul is greatly filled with the scoffing of those who are at ease and with the contempt of the proud. Verses 3 and 4 talks about the trouble that comes from the outside, which we know all too well. And then the trust is what the psalm is all about, which is what's on the inside. So trouble comes from the outside, but it's met with trust on the inside. Inside, our hope, and that's the key phrase, until he is gracious to us. The key phrase of the thought of the psalm is verse 2, the last line, until he is gracious to us. So here again, here's another beautiful psalm. Not hard to memorize these short psalms at all. In fact, scholars believe, and you would expect this, that the reason why these are songs of ascents is that they could well, the Jewish people memorize a lot more than we do anyway, but they're easy to recite. Yes.
So in the truth, when it says until he has mercy on us, could that be talking about when we go to heaven? Because we wouldn't ever want to take our eyes off of him.
Mm-hmm.
Until, okay, now I don't have to, unless
mm-hmm.
it's, I mean, you know, we're in heaven.
Okay, well, that's a good question. Maybe I'll see if I would venture to answer it. But anyone else want to venture an answer to that question? Yes.
I was thinking of the other use of until in one of the letters to Timothy, when Paul says, "Can you preach the word until I come to you?" And he's not going to stop preaching the word when Paul comes to visit.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes until doesn't mean that there will be a termination, but there can be a continuance after until. But
that's for sure. Right. She was asking about whether this is heaven.
Well, I just meant that it doesn't necessitate that the mercy is going to glory because it's not implying that we're going to look away when he's in
that. Say that last part again. It's not implying that what?
Well, if they use the word until, it doesn't mm-hmm. necessarily imply that we're going to look away from God when we receive the mercy we're looking for.
Oh, sure, that it extends afterwards. Right. Okay, gotcha. Mm-hmm. Well, I think that would be limiting it, Michelle, to put it that far off because of the prayer in verse 3. Notice that it's a great connection there. Our eyes look to the Lord until he is gracious to us, and then the prayer is be gracious to us. So that's what you want. You're looking for it. You're looking for it now, so. For we are greatly filled with contempt. So the need is now, the prayer is for now, and we just hold on to the Lord until he answers the prayer and gives us the grace for that particular situation. So let's do the next psalm, pushing ahead here, Psalm 125. This was the hardest one for me, because... Well, it talks about, well, it's a comparison. It starts off as a comparison. Usually the comparison comes afterwards. But this one starts off as a comparison. Those who trust in the Lord are as Mount Zion, which cannot be moved but abides forever. As the mountains surround Jerusalem, so the Lord surrounds his people from this time forth and forever. And then it transitions, starting at verse 3, it transitions in verse 3 to the trouble again. These psalms are filled with trouble. Some of them are exclusively about trouble. Psalm 120, Psalm 124. There are several of those. But so then it transitions to that. So for me, I know I was going back and forth as to how to get to the main idea of the psalm. And so settled on the idea of steadfast faith because of the word moved, cannot be moved. Once again, sometimes you look for a phrase or an idea that seems to dominate, in this case, in a psalm. So the other one was until he is gracious. So this one is cannot be moved, but abides forever. So that's the point, that those who trust in the Lord cannot be moved, or to put it another way, those who trust in the Lord have a steadfast faith. So you could call that the theme of the psalm. And that fits with trusting, because trusting in the Lord requires a steadfast faith. So then if we isolate that as the main idea, steadfast faith, we can say that verses 1 and 2, well, this is what I settled on. It took me a while to get to this. But steadfast faith illustrated, verses 1 and 2. And then steadfast faith at work, verses 3 through 5. Now, there might be a better way to say that, but that's the best I can come up with. Steadfast faith illustrated and steadfast faith at work. So the steadfast faith at work, I'm just trying to say that it involves, you see in verse 3, it involves processing some truth, which is what you have in verse 3. The scepter of wickedness shall not rest on the land of the righteous, so the righteous will not put forth their hands to do wrong. So wickedness is not going to overrule the life of the righteous. So that's part of this steadfast faith at work. You know, and I think we go through this in life. When we try to deal with life situations, we talk to ourselves and we apply the truth that we have to those particular situations, whether it be evil or someone troubling us or something troubling us, some circumstance or some situation. We try to process that and put it in to our hearts so that we can proceed with faith. And then in verses 4 and 5, you have the same idea. Steadfast faith at work. Do good to those who are good, to those who are upright in their hearts. Comparing the righteous to the wicked. And then the final prayer, peace be upon Israel. So, as I call this, I related this to number 626, the Lord give you peace, because it ends with that prayer, peace be upon Israel. So we can call this one steadfast faith. Steadfast faith at work. Kyle Dalich has some good explanation of what he calls the inducement to apostasy. In other words, that when the wicked are around us and they're putting pressure on us, there's that tendency for us to depart from the faith. And I immediately thought of Hebrews. We're studying Hebrews back home in the Sunday school, so I immediately thought of Hebrews. This was exactly the problem that those Hebrew Christians were facing. Probably written to Christians living during the time of Nero's persecution, and having had the security of Judaism and now facing this fiery trial from in the civil realm, they were thinking, well, it's really not worth it. You know, Moses is good enough. Judaism is good enough. And so you have the writer of that book coming out and saying, well, you know, Christ is better than Moses. Christ is better than Aaron. And Christ is a high priest according to the order of Melchizedek. And in several key places in the book of Hebrews, he's saying to them, you know, you'll be saved if you hold fast your confidence and your faith firm until the end. So there is that if of perseverance. And that's what this psalm is talking about. A steadfast faith under the pressure or in the midst of the workings of wickedness. So inducement to apostasy is there. The temptation to apostasy is there, and the need to have a steadfast faith is greater. All right, so that's the third of these beautiful psalms. Now we come to the last one. We're doing pretty well on the time, so we might be able to spend a little more time on this. So Psalm 131. O Lord, my heart is not proud, nor my eyes haughty or lifted up, nor do I involve myself in great matters or in things too difficult for me. Surely I have composed and quieted my soul like a weaned child rests against his mother. My soul is like a weaned child within me. O Israel, hope in the Lord from this time forth and forever. So, let's see. Well, since we do have a little time, I'll let you do this now. So, how many sections would you say this little psalm divides up into? Three. Excellent. You got it. And the three verses, three sections. So, it doesn't always work that way, but in this case it does. So Teresa got it. Okay, so how would you epitomize or categorize the first section, which is verse 1? What is that? What is that? What is he doing there?
Speaking against pride.
Okay, keep going. What's that? Yes, showing humility. But when he says, but look at the language, when he says, my heart is not proud, what would we call that? What he's doing there? Not, no.
Introspection.
Introspection, okay, that's you're getting closer. Well, that's right, but... Yeah, that's right. It is. It is that. Okay. My heart is not proud, nor my eyes haughty, nor do I involve myself in great matters. I was thinking of the word confession. So it's not necessarily the only right answer, but it's a kind of a confession. There are different kinds of confessions in the Bible. Can you think of any others? Confession of sin. Confession of
reliance on God.
Confession of faith. A more popular one, we think of a confession of faith. Confession of sin. This one is a confession of reliance on God, or a confession of humility. So that's the first verse, or the first part. Yeah.
Somewhat analogous to Romans 12, where he understands who he is. He recognizes himself in his proper position.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You know, how he sits in the world.
Most definitely. It is. It's a confession of humility. It's a confession of a sober assessment of yourself. Yeah. Yeah, that's very good. So we said that the psalm is three parts, and the first is a confession. The second part, which is verse 2, what's going on there? What is he giving us there? A simile. Very good, yeah. A simile. Very good. A simile. Like. All right. So a simile, a metaphor using like or as. So it's a simile, it's an illustration. It's an illustration of contentment. So this is a confession of humility, or a confession of a sober assessment, an illustration of humility. And then what would be verse 3? How could we, what would we call it? Yes,
Dave. I was thinking with verse 2 that it's also, it shows distinct affection. It's not only describing the condition of his soul, it's also illustrating the relationship of a only child with his mother. Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems to be almost putting God in that position. We know there are a couple other times that the Lord draws upon a mother's love or a mother's peculiar affection.
Yeah, that's excellent. Yeah, that's excellent. Verse 2. So now to verse 3 then, what's that? In the psalm here, he's talking about himself, he's talking about the weaned child, and then he says, he looks out and he says, "Oh Israel, hope in the Lord from this time forth and forever."
Exhortation.
It's some kind of an exhortation to what?
Confidence in God.
Emulation.
Emulation? Yes, that's good. It's a call to them, O Israel, hope in the Lord. It's a call to what he's, what he, well, how does the hope part, it's a call to hope in the Lord. So why does he say hope if he's talked about contentment? And we will have some time to look at the words and the language and the meaning of the illustration in just a minute. But, in verse 3, why doesn't he say, O Israel, you know, rest in the Lord?
Is it a realization that the Lord is our only hope?
For sure. But why does he put that thought in there when you would think he would say rest in the Lord? Because the weaned child is resting against his mother, right? And is weaned, so he's not looking for milk. Yeah, I think that's really the idea. So you're doing really well this morning. So that's the idea. It's he could have said rest in the Lord, but by saying hope in the Lord, he's actually applying it. He's taking it to its where you would expect him to take it. That when we hope in the Lord, we all our hope is in the Lord. And it relates to the earlier psalm, that we look to the Lord until he is gracious to us. That's the idea of hope. All of these ideas are intertwined, and we've talked about them in previous studies on the psalms: rest, trust, hope, waiting. Psalm 34 uses all of those words synonymously: trust, rest, wait. And here you have things like look. Here you have this illustration of the weaned child who now can just rest upon his mother and be perfectly content. So we have the three sections. Let's spend a little bit of time looking at the two main ideas then, the confession. We've already talked about how there are different kinds of confession. Confession is of sin, confession of faith, confession of humility. You have the confession of righteousness with the whole class of psalms that we studied, the integrity psalms, where the psalmist says, "I am a righteous man." We usually say, "I'm a sinner." We tell people, "You know, I'm a sinner just like you," and we understand what we're trying to do there. But we should be able to give a confession of integrity. So, "I'm a righteous man. I do not consider myself a sinner. That is, someone who's practicing sin. I consider myself as a person who's trying to overcome sin." And so that's another type of confession, a confession of integrity, which we see in the book of Psalms. So in verse 1, it's a denial of things, of certain things, with a corresponding positive confession. Notice it's stated negatively. 1, my heart is not proud, nor my eyes haughty. That's the same thing. So it's just, that's poetic symmetry. My heart is not proud, nor my eyes haughty is just saying the same thing. So that's one thing that he's saying. He's denying pride, haughtiness. It's interesting that the word haughty means eyes lifted up. And then we have that psalm that we just studied, "To you I lift up my eyes." So it's just a matter, everybody lifts up their eyes somewhere. It's just, what are you lifting it up to? You're lifting it up to the Lord to look to him, or you're up your eyes because you're proud, and basically you just, all you see is yourself in your own eyes. That's pride. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, nor this matter, do I involve myself in great matters or in things too difficult for me? That seems to be a parallelism as well. So that would not be talking of two separate things, but only one thing. So there are two things that he's talking about in verse 1. And this is how we try to interpret poetry. I'm actually practicing for my upcoming ministry in Nepal, teaching hermeneutics. So this is what we should do when we study poetry, because poetry is characterized by parallelisms or synonymous lines or antithetical lines. The second line says the opposite of what the first line says, and then imagery. So he says four things. My heart is not proud, my eyes haughty, I don't involve myself in great matters or in things too difficult for me. So he says four things, but he's really only saying two things. Next time, what are the two things? No pride. Yeah, this is an interesting one, right? This is the one where it was like, wow, what does that mean? David's the king. I mean, if the servant says this, it's one thing, but the king is saying this. So this is really interesting that David is saying this. I don't involve myself in great matters or in things too difficult for me. So you have two things here, a renunciation of pride and some kind of a renunciation of, this is an interesting one. Not self-seeking, because it's maybe self-glory or something like that. Glory, great man. I want to be involved in something really great. So that idea.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so, okay, so you're asking what I think about that. So I think that it definitely has to do with the first thing that you said. It doesn't seem to be the main idea, but it definitely relates to Deuteronomy 29:29. Yeah. Delving into mysteries because things too difficult, and great matters on the part of David seem to be referring to I wouldn't limit it to that, because it just seems to be relating to things that he does. It's difficult coming from David, because David did a lot of great things.
Well, what I was thinking when you said this is David, obviously it says it's the Song of David.
Right.
Well, here's David, who had been anointed king, and then he's running around in the wilderness, running away from Saul, and he's trying to figure all this out. But who is the one who does know what's going on? It's only the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
So he can recognize, okay, I'm just a creature here on earth, and I can't delve into the mystery of how I've been anointed king, and yet I'm fleeing in the wilderness, mm-hmm. those kinds of things. So in his long life experience, and obviously in many of the patriarchs and so forth, you have these same kinds of mysteries being worked out, and they're too great for us.
Mm-hmm.
So hope in the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
It goes back to that exhortation later.
Yeah, like, and that fits with the first thing that you said, is the Deuteronomy 29:29. Mm-hmm. So that fits with that, what you just said.
Yeah, more in light of like providence.
Sure, well, providence. Yes, I agree with that. In Psalm 139 and verse 6, back to what David said, such knowledge is too wonderful for me, it is too high, I cannot attain to it. And thinking about this, it seems, yes, Dan. I'm still thinking this through myself. So this is the one thing today that I'm not really settled on. So I think you all may be hitting, or this may be the main idea here, not so much things that he's doing, but just mysteries like Job.
Well, I was going to say, and I should use the word always, but my first impression was just that this is, he's just giving an example, a common example of someone who is proud and is haughty. They tend to involve themselves in great matters. You know, they push themselves in because they don't have an honest self-assessment.
Yes.
They think they're more than they are, and so they push themselves into things that really are beyond them, just in a general sense.
Right.
Not necessarily in the big race.
Okay, so that's good.
But just more generally, it's just an example.
Yeah. That's good, yeah. And Jerry had already mentioned the Romans 12, so I was about to say before that Romans 12:3 is a passage that seems to shed a lot of light on this, which is just what you said just now, Rob, is that don't think more highly of yourself than you ought to think, but think as to have sound judgment, as God has allotted to each a measure of faith. And then he talks about the different gifts in the church. That is the things that we involve ourselves with. So in the few minutes that we have left, I did want to point out that this confession of humility, and with the illustration, we're not going to get to that, is not a confession of a person who doesn't accomplish much. Be careful of that. It's not a person who doesn't accomplish much, because you have verses like 1 Chronicles 12 and verse 32 speaks of the sons of Issachar, men who understood the times with knowledge of what Israel should do. And Daniel 11 and verse 32, but the people who know their God will display strength and take action. And then the Job passage as well. So then the verse 2, let me say a few words about that, is the lesson of the weaned child. And Well, some of you moms are nursing, and you know you know this is all you know this, or maybe you're in the process of weaning the child. But this is the hardest lesson that the little baby has to learn, right? This is it. This is the hardest lesson. And interestingly, David uses this. The king is talking about himself like a weaned child. How humble is that? David is quite a humble man. But the image is just so clear. It's so easy to see the point of the image, the lesson that the child has to go through. The whole point is that the weaned child is content. He is content. The child is content with his mother and not what his mother gives him in the feeding. It's close to Psalm 121. I will lift up my eyes to the mountains, from where my help shall come. It's close to Psalm 123. To you I lift up my eyes, O you who are enthroned in the heavens. So may the Lord grant us the contentment of which this beautiful image speaks. Let's pray. O Lord, we thank you for these precious gems of Psalms, and we are grateful, Lord, that they teach us trust, rest, being at peace with you, contentment, and also putting ourselves in the proper perspective, O Lord. We pray that you will help us, Lord, to be what your word and your will requires us to be, a people who soberly assess ourselves and who don't think higher or lower than ourselves than we ought to think. We ask this in Christ's name. Amen.